I have had very little instruction. This is going to be terrible, but we're going to give it a go.
Welcome to the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. I'm your co-host, Alex Merkel.
And I'm Josh Randles. And this is where evidence-based medicine meets unconventional warfare.
The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speaker's own, and nothing contained herein is to be considered the official opinion of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine or the U.S. government, including the Defense Health Agency, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Navy, or Air Force.
Greetings again and always. This is Dan Godby, Medical Editor of the Journal of Special Operations Medicine. Thank you for joining us for the fall edition of the JSOM podcast. For this introduction, I will emphasize a few additional articles well worth reading. The Yugoslav Guerrilla Hospital article is a historical piece that every special operations medical person should read. It's about one of the most memorable G hospital experiences in history, and much of our current training is based on this paradigm. Altered sympathoadrenal activity following cold weather diving is a well-written and superbly presented manuscript, very appealing to DMOs and DMTs. As always, we at the JSOM are interested in hearing from our readership, particularly those of you in the primary positions, and I would again like to reiterate our mentoring program specifically created to help medics get through the publishing process. A select group of editors are dedicated to concentrate on articles submitted by medics and provide assistance in getting them published. Now, here's Alex and Josh with the podcast.
Well, Josh, the nip of fall is in the air and it's about ready to be hunting season, but most importantly, from a clinical perspective, our civilian trauma center lately has gotten a number of civilian trauma patients who came in with tourniquets that were applied in the pre-hospital environment, and it really made me think about our levels of practice and ability, whether it's civilian or in the military. And so while these guys do operate under some very specific protocols, really they were just having this muscle memory reflex because they had been taught very, very well about how to apply tourniquets, not necessarily taught about when to apply tourniquets. And that really holds true, I think, for a lot of our military training as well. We do a really great job in our initial training about how to do procedures, but we really fall far short on sustainment training, and I think we all probably would agree that we also fall short on really teaching people the why about many of the interventions and procedures that we do or when we should do them. And you know, that really rings true to what somebody taught me years ago, which is that if you are a technician, you do things because you are told that you shall do them under standard operating procedures. The clinicians who tend to use their gestalt and decision making really use guidelines to ask themselves the question of if they could do something. And it gets to the heart of the matter that just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should do something. And that's really where the clinical decision making comes from the extensive experience and the sets and reps of taking care of our critically ill patients. And I think it really speaks to the spectrum and the continuity of care for our patients. When you're at POI, there's a lot of knee-jerk reflexes that you shall do, especially when you're in a semi-permissive environment or a kinetic tactical environment. But then as you move out of that kinetic high-threat environment, you get to the you should do type of practice patterns. And that continues, I think, for you and I in the recess bay. But then when we get those patients up to either the operating room or the ICU for their ongoing resuscitation, that's when we really start doing our chin scratching and asking ourselves, what could we do? And it's important to know that all three of those practice patterns are important and all of them have the right time and place to do it. But certainly we tend to see a lot of our physicians in the pre-hospital environment scratching their chin when they ought to just move the patient. And we tend to see some of our less clinically experienced clinicians when they come into MPT experience in the recess bay or in the ICU who try to operate in a knee-jerk manner when really there should be more thought process involved. And so we all play a part and we all just need to think about when it's important to act with that rapid type 1 thinking and when we've got time and it's important to really think critically about our patients. And in that same vein about critically thinking about patient care, what article have you got for us this month?
Well, Alex, our first paper today is slow intravenous infusion of a novel damage control cocktail decreases blood loss in a pig polytrauma model. This paper is by Nathan White, Chloe Asato, Andrew Wenthe et al. So the authors here state that the current combat medics lack, quote, logistical options for providing whole blood transfusions to multiple casualties and for sustaining polytrauma patients over prolonged periods of time, unquote, given the amount of supply that they are able to carry in their aid bags and on their person. The investigators have been developing a multifunctional damage control resuscitation, or DCR cocktail, containing Hextend as an intravascular expander, vasopressin to support neurovascular tone, and fibrinogen concentrate to support hemostasis. Previous studies have led to the current formulations, and the investigators were attempting to determine the most appropriate IV delivery method, be that a bolus or slow infusion. Their primary outcomes were intraperitoneal blood loss, measured at time of death or at 3 hours, and intraperitoneal blood loss as a bleeding rate. Secondary outcomes were hemodynamics, metabolic rates of resuscitation, CBCs, ROTEM measurements, and vital organ microvascular blood flow. Their methods are quite extensive. In essence, they caused a very controlled TBI, a femur fracture, hemorrhagic shock that they caused iatrogenically, and free bleeding from an aortic tear injury in two populations of Sus scrofa domestica. They had a total of 18, and they randomized 9 into each arm. In one, they administered their DCR cocktail over 10 minutes, twice, with a total dose each time of 10 mLs per kilogram, totaling to 20 mLs per kilogram per subject. In the infusion arm, they infused the cocktail at a rate of 0.33 mLs per K per minute to achieve the same dose, a total of 20 mLs per K over 1 hour. They then monitored the subjects until death or 3 hours, whichever came first, and took appropriate measurements as described in the methods. The infusion population demonstrated decreased intraperitoneal hemorrhage, decreased total hemorrhage volume, and improved MAP over the time span. However, there were no significant differences in survival time, lactate, ROTEM measurements, which in this case is indicative of whether the coagulopathy was improved. The authors are very clear in their discussion that they don't intend this medication to be a replacement for whole blood administration, but as an adjunct to help extend that vital resource in an austere scenario. They're also very clear on their limitations, including their small population, their animal model, and that they didn't test their vasopressin administrations alone against their cocktail. However, I will give them credit for the conclusion and that it reflects the data that they found, and that is that our results suggest that the rate of infusion is an important variable that should be considered and tested when designing resuscitative fluids for DCR of polytrauma with non-compressible torso hemorrhage. So I think they're very honest in that they are just trying to test and see if they can find a fluid to extend the supply of whole blood in, you know, a scenario where there's going to be no supply or that a medic can't carry that much. I think they're also honest that this probably isn't the fluid. I would have preferred that they also tested the vasopressin alone versus the vasopressin in their scenario. They do refer in their paper that they have looked at vasopressin alone versus their fluid, but that was only in a bolus. And we tend to give vasopressin as a drip over long periods of time. That's what we use it for, to maintain that tone. I think they analyzed the data well, and I think this is a good indication of, yes, the method of administering the medication matters. But also, I don't think this is the medication we're looking for quite yet.
Next, we've got our guest editor section, coordinated by Devin DeFeo.
All right, this is Devin DeFeo with the guest editor for Fall 23, Derek Fiskin. Derek was a Marine Raider, now Air Force PJ. Derek, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it. I understand you have a pretty cool paper to talk about today. It's about ultrasound and use for diagnosing rib fractures. And there's a couple of docs that did this in the ED, but then made the comparison to an operator in the field. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Today, I'll be reviewing a prospective case study, pain control and point of care ultrasound an approach to rib fractures for the osteo provider. The study was authored by Reese Snyder, who's a PA, and Dr. Dan Brillhart, and it was published by the Journal of Special Operations Medicine.
Awesome. What clinical questions did the authors propose?
So to me, the first question that was really posed was, are there any glaring gaps in literature? And they do discuss a gap in literature. They identified it as there's a very limited research base on perineural injection therapy, which was the primary modality for pain control in this particular case. And then how you can use that to diagnose rib fractures and manage patient pain in an austere environment. Secondly, I feel like the authors are trying to identify how special operations medical providers working with very limited imaging diagnostic capabilities can effectively diagnose and treat rib fractures, utilizing a very standardized approach that will ultimately reduce unnecessary medical evacuations from the field.
Yeah, it sounds applicable for our field of work for sure. What methods did the authors use to answer these questions?
The authors, they offered the following methodology and what you can do to successfully examine, identify, confirm the diagnosis of a rib fracture, and then treat it in an environment with limited capabilities. They started with their initial evaluation, so obviously this starts with a very detailed physical exam and review of systems. From there, they conducted, you know, initial laboratory work to assess for potential infection, any renal impairment, or any other bony abnormalities that could have been presenting problems for the patient. And then thirdly, they review the past medical history to rule out any developed abnormalities that may be presenting for the first time with the patient. So like specifically in this case, the patient had elevated creatinine levels. So they conducted another bedside renal ultrasound to rule out any sort of kidney impairment. And then when they went back and reviewed his medical records, they saw that his current creatinine level was trending like over the last couple of years.
And can you tell the listeners what the mechanism of injury in this case study was?
Yeah, so for this patient, he was working out, he fell, and then the way his body contorted, he said that he immediately had non-localized back and flank pain. Mm-hmm. And then later on in the day, he was sitting in his room and he sneezed and he felt an immediate sensation of like a popping sensation in his side, and the muscles around where he felt the pop immediately tensed up, and that's when he decided to go to the emergency department.
Okay, and then in the ED, what did the providers make their diagnosis with? How did they go about it?
So when the patient presented in the emergency room, he came in. He said that he had unspecified back and flank pain. He told them what had happened. They determined that it was a low velocity injury. So they went through their protocol. They started with a chest x-ray. The chest x-ray was unremarkable. From there, they continued to palpate around T11, which is where he said he had the maximal amount of tenderness. They decided to go with a perineural injections along the nerve, the T11 nerve. And then once he said that his pain was managed, they were able to do a more thorough palpation of the area. That is when they felt crepitus around T11, and then they were able to do a bedside ultrasound to confirm the rib fracture of the T11 rib.
And so the primary outcome was diagnosing the rib fracture, is that correct?
Yeah, so the rib fracture being successfully diagnosed utilizing point of care ultrasound was the primary outcome. And then I would say in this case the secondary outcome would be using pain management through perineural injections vice going to some sort of narcotic adjunct. And then by doing so, they were able to get numbness and able to palpate and do a much more thorough exam of the patient's side. And then additionally, once the patient was, he completed his exam, there was no need for any follow-up care or follow-on pain treatment.
What would you say are three strengths of this paper?
So to me, I would say one, it was a very detailed case presentation, and I feel like the authors had a very comprehensive diagnosis of how to identify, confirm, and treat a rib fracture. And then that kind of leads me into my second point, which I feel like this paper does an amazing job highlighting the importance of point-of-care ultrasound and how it can really be applied for us in an austere setting as a means of expedience and ultimately resource preservation. And then most importantly, I feel like it provides a very practical and non-invasive solution for, you know, us soft medics to be able to provide patient care.
Do you think the paper had any weaknesses?
Yeah, so one weakness is that it only uses a single case. Secondly, it really lacks a comparative analysis in terms of cost, efficiency, and what training requirements or time requirements would be needed in order to achieve currency and then maintain that currency for some providers. And I can speak, so personally being a PJ, perineural injections and ultrasound skills are not something that we practice often. So, and then in terms of like doing perineural injections, like these are skills that we can learn. Like we definitely have the bandwidth and the time to learn them. And, you know, PJs are skilled enough to do this. But when you start talking about like, what are the potential complications if you go too deep? So these are just all things that I think we, you know, the paper doesn't necessarily address. And then finally, I feel like the paper fails to discuss potential complications of misdiagnosis when utilizing point of care ultrasound versus the chest x-ray.
Yeah, it sounds like a more thorough study would be needed to be able to do that. But hey, when you're in the field, it might be all you have, right?
Correct, yeah.
Very cool. So do you think this changes your clinical practice or gives you ideas for, you know, how your clinical practice could be improved?
So no, for me, like, I don't think that this would change a clinical practice. I, as a provider, I would feel most comfortable trying to get this guy to somewhere that has definitive imaging, but that's only because of the absence of training. And so I think, you know, while this paper is not going to change protocol, I think what it does do very well is open up the door for follow-on studies and an investigative process into a more in-depth analysis of the benefits of utilizing point-of-care ultrasound in an austere environment.
Thanks a lot for doing this tonight. Really appreciate it. What's next for you after being a PJ?
So I have a year left, and then I'll be returning to school to pursue a joint MD Master's in Public Health program.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, good luck with that. You definitely have all the makings for success. Thanks, Derek.
Thanks, Devin. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Coming soon to the JSON family are ASMR, Audiosensory Military Response Stream. Hello, friends. I'm so glad you've joined me tonight. I've got some really soothing and rhythmic sounds for you. I've heard some of you have been extra stressed, having trouble sleeping. We thought this might just be what you need to relax. Please enjoy the rhythmic, soothing sound. It seems some of our listeners may have hearing loss from combat deployments. Let's try a different soothing sound for you listeners out there.
I still can't hear anything. I've got tinnitus.
Well, listeners, I know that was just what some of you needed, but some of you might need a little soothing sound that's perhaps a little louder. Let's give this a try. Relax. Well, that's just a little bit of a taste of what's coming soon to the JSON family, our ASMR, Audiosensory Military Response. Look for it in your podcast stream. Good night.
And our last article this edition is titled Phosphorus Burn Management with a multimodal analgesia. And this is a bit of a pivot from us. It's actually a case report from one of our NATO special operations medical assets. In brief summary, they highlight the case of a EOD specialist from one of our NATO partners who ended up having what we would call in the hospital a misadventure with some pyro, causing immediate injury with white phosphorus. And one of the main reasons that we chose this article is because white phosphorus has been talked about recently in the community because it's so terrifying and so difficult to treat. So the authors here talked about their initial care management, their extended care management, their analgesia to augment their ability to provide appropriate care, as well as specialty care teleconsult. So really just a great, I would say flash to bang, but that feels a bit inappropriate, on the continuity of care for this critically injured special operations service member from one of our partner forces. So I don't want to spoil much of the surprise, and I will encourage everyone out there to read through this one in detail, because there's a lot of great lessons to be gleaned from the manuscript itself, from some really high-speed folks who very obviously had prepared for this injury pattern ahead of time.
Yeah, as Alex said, this is an article that we can base up of our typical Centers of Evidence-Based Medicine checklist to see if it meets the standard for a well-written and well-designed research study. But Alex and I both agree that there is something to be learned from this paper, and we're looking forward to our discussion with the author.
Well, to answer some of our questions about this particular manuscript, we are lucky enough to have one of the primary authors with us to provide a little bit more insight. Dr. St. Jean, welcome to the show, sir.
Hello, sir. Thank you and JSOM for allowing me to talk about this case report and share our daily challenge in France with the scientific community interested in soft medicine.
Yeah, and we particularly enjoyed picking this manuscript because, first off, you and your team did just a wonderful job managing a critically ill patient, but also your manuscript highlighted just such a number of important different topics within austere and soft medicine, including the white phosphorus component, as well as burn care in general, and your far-forward critical care. And we'd just really like to take the time to applaud you and your colleagues for the outstanding patient care you provided, and also sharing your experience with the wider community.
Yeah, pleasure to share answers.
And so moving into some of the specific questions we had about your experience, we were curious if you could tell us a little bit more about the capabilities of the first AMS and what physician specialties you have with your team.
Yeah, sure. So the first AMS is a medical treatment facility handling role 1 care level belonging to the French Military Health Service. It's settled nearby Paris, providing primary care and emergency care. Its main task is ensuring the medical support of the Group d'Intervention de la Gendarmerie Nationale, known as GIGN, an elite law enforcement special unit tasked on national territory but also worldwide. First responder in case of counterterrorism in France, hostage situations, threatening armed madmen, but also fighting against organized crime such as high-risk intervention, drug trafficking, kidnapping, sequestration. In each of these situations, First AMS is alongside operators with a tactical emergency medical support, including a medical doctor and a nurse able to provide emergency care in austere and remote situations. And to answer more specifically to the second question, dozens of military doctors and nurses are enlisted at the first AMS, working together to arm two tactical emergency medical support, 24/7 all year long, ready to go in 30 minutes or 2 hours. They specialized in emergency medicine, disaster medicine, sports medicine, CBRN events. They are also trained to follow the operators in all remote situations.
And I think those of us who have attended the SOMA conference have certainly heard about a number of the events you and your team have supported both domestically and internationally with your tip of the spear operator. So thanks for that background. In reading through your manuscript, we were also curious if it's typical for a French burn center to request that a patient remain at your level of care for the length of time you noted in your submission.
So, thanks for asking. No, it's not typical for a burn center to request this from a primary care facility. However, the advice was taken at a Parisian military burns treatment center. The specialist therefore knows the autonomy and experience of the military doctors working for First AMS. They have all been deployed in overseas operations, sometimes in remote locations. In these situations, they had to manage patients alone with telemedicine advice. So it is mutual knowledge between military doctors that facilitated this unusual and original management.
And we very much enjoyed hearing about your detailed analysis of your intranasal administration, and I've certainly read a number of your JSOM submissions previously noting this. We're curious about where this protocol came from and if there are other medical societies that have published this, and curious if you have previous experience to this event.
Yeah, sure. So we started it because we were looking for an analgesic protocol adapted to our tactical medicine practice. Indeed, analgesia in hostile environments is an unresolved issue. But also in situations of many victims, like mass shooting events or disaster medicine, it can be an interesting way. The intranasal allows an approach without vascular access, easy to implement, freeing itself from the technical, time, and logistical constraints of other approaches. It also allows the extraction of one or more victims to a safe place. The use of ketamine is already described and used in tactical combat casualty care, and we read it attentively, and so we try to do the same actually. And it's interesting because the French Military Health Service is now supplied with pre-filled ketamine device intranasally. So it's a move on for us.
I didn't know you guys were getting pre-filled. That is really interesting. And in reading through your summary, you mentioned that you do not have ultrasound capability at your facility. Is that something you're interested in gaining in the future?
Actually, we have an ultrasound machine, a Titan from Sonosite, but that day we chose not to use it. We stuck to the anatomical landmarks of a regional anesthesia block of the hand, probably explaining its partial effectiveness. We probably have not been accurate enough in the landmarks we chose, and it's why we had to go for intranasal too. So using an ultrasound machine would have been a good idea for us. After this procedure, we were trained in ultrasound-guided regional anesthesia with the help of a specialist anesthesiologist, allowing a better assessment of emergency care. This contributed to make us better. So we also believe that ultrasound is a game changer device in emergency and primary care facility. So for the orientation during damage control resuscitation to damage control surgery.
Well, again, Dr. Saint-Jean, thank you so much for your time today, helping to explain a little bit more about your organized approach to your patient care and also the impressive strides you and your team have made to improving the care delivery for our tip of the spear soldiers, regardless of nationality. We really appreciate your insight.
Yeah, thanks to you to give us a chance to share this management.
Well, Alex, that's another episode of the JSON Podcast in the books. We hope you all have had as much fun reading as we've had talking about this fall 2023 edition.
Please do remember that you all, as actively practicing operational medicine specialists at the tip of the spear, have a lot of wisdom and experience to share. And the Special Operations Medical Association conference should be open by the time we release this for podium presentations, lab presentations, which is 2, 4, or 8 hour hands-on educational workshops, as well as posters and research track. And we would be very excited to see all of you out there in the community submitting to help share your experience with the wider audience at SOMA next year. As always, please do reach out to us. Give us feedback, criticism, opportunities for improvement. We are always eager to find out how we can make a better product to assist your practice out in the operational environment. Thanks as always. We'll see you again soon.
This is Sophia Rodriguez, Director of Marketing and Social Media Communications for the JSOM. I want to encourage our listeners to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at JSOM Online, and to sign up to receive our free e-newsletter on our website at jsomonline.org. We love hearing from our subscribers and followers, and welcome your feedback and suggestions.